morning and welcome to the conversation on this Martin Luther King Day. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We live in a world where there are any number of threats to our physical safety, well-being, yeah?
We do, and how we go about mitigating those or even changing our attitudes about how we mitigate those is part of what was discussed last Friday as we were going into the weekend. Now, the term harm reduction may seem self-explanatory, but for those who work in the field, the philosophies and strategies have an explicit meaning to reduce the potential dangers and health risks associated with potentially harmful behaviors. And there are a lot of those, from drug abuse to immigration to Native Hawaiian interventions, and you can fill in the blanks for many more. Columbia professor Carl Hart was the keynote speaker at last Friday's Harm Reduction Conference. He joins us now. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You travel all over the world to be able to talk about all kinds of policies that have to do with mitigating the harm that people can potentially do to themselves. In Hawaii, we talk a lot about meth. We've talked a lot about marijuana. As you look at Hawaii through the lens of your worldwide travels, how do you view us?
Well, you have to understand that I am a scientist first, and so what I do is I study the effects of drugs like methamphetamine, as well as cannabis, as well as crack cocaine. As part of my research, we actually give these drugs, and we give these drugs to try to understand treatment better, and we try to understand under what conditions we can expect positive effects and under what conditions we can expect negative effects to help keep people safe. And so as I think about Hawaii, the issues are related. In terms of drugs, the major issues are methamphetamine and cannabis. And so if we think about methamphetamine, one of the things that happens is that we have exaggerated the harmful effects associated with methamphetamine. That's not to say that the drug is not potentially dangerous. It certainly can be. But we blame some of the issues of poverty and all of these things on methamphetamine, as opposed to being able to focus on these other issues. So when we start to blame those other issues, then we're not really helping to solve our problems, and we also are inefficient and ineffective.
It sounds as if what you're also saying is that we not only blame that particular issue, it's methamphetamine, for example, but we look at only focusing on that as the panacea to mitigate the problem.
Yes, exactly. And we waste a lot of money doing that sort of thing as well. And we don't keep our societies any safer. And so if we look beyond the drug itself, we might actually try to figure out what the problems are.
So what do you see when you look beyond the drug?
When I think about any drugs, we think about methamphetamine. It's important for y'all and the audience to know that methamphetamine has been and is used currently by a number of militaries around the world. So that means that the drug can be used to keep soldiers awake, more alert, fight better, and so forth. And the drug is also FDA approved to treat attention deficit disorder and also obesity. So it's important for people to understand that the drug has potential positive effects and beneficial effects. And so the drug is not uniquely dangerous. If you know that, now you can start to say, well, what about these people who are having problems? Because there are people who use methamphetamine and they have problems. It tells you that, well, we have to look beyond the drug because other people, like militaries and so forth, are using the drugs safely. So what is it about those people who are having problems? If we can figure that out, then we could actually maybe help solve their problems and keep our societies safer.
That seems to be the same approach to looking at just about any drug that could be easily abused, any prescription drug.
That's exactly right. Or even alcohol. For example, alcohol has potential beneficial effects. It relieves anxiety. It's a social lubricant. But we know that there are people who have problems. There are some people who overdo it. And so we have to ask questions like, well, what is it about those people? What's going on under these conditions that increase the likelihood of people having problems?
At the conference on Friday, you talked a lot about addiction as a brain disease and how that moves into social injustice.
Yeah.
What's that connection?
Yeah, so today we think about addiction as a brain disease, but there is almost no evidence of that. And so we have all of this attention focused on, if you think about addiction as a brain disease, it leaves you with one or two approaches. Then you want to make sure that you fix the brains of those people who use the drugs. That's number one. Or number two, you want to remove the drug from society, and that way you don't have the drug interacting with people's brain. But it doesn't leave any room to think about the social environment under which those people are living or people who are having problems. And so the notion that drug addiction is a brain disease, first of all, is not supported by any evidence, certainly not evidence in humans. But we tend to believe that. And a lot of the funding, is particularly research funding, goes into this model. And when the research funding is going into that model, it's not looking at social factors that are involved. And so since we are on this Martin Luther King Day, for example, I think about Martin Luther King opposition to the war in Vietnam, for example. He said that he was opposed to the war in Vietnam because it took away money from poor people, or it took away resources from focusing on the issues of poor people. That's what's happening with this whole notion that addiction is a brain disease.
So can I ask you about some of what we have seen come out that we have been told that as people use certain drugs in certain people, in certain populations, that rewires the brain and that it stops its full growth. If, for example, a child starts to experiment at age 14 or 16, that the brain kind of goes on hiatus for a while until the drug is no longer in the system. How do you respond to that kind of research that we hear a lot about?
No, that's a great question. So when you say rewiring the brain, so you use these nebulous terms, and that's a nebulous term. I have a PhD in neuroscience. I don't even know what that means.
I'm asking you.
No, but you're absolutely right, because we hear it in the public, and that's a great question. But it doesn't mean anything. There's no evidence of that. I mean, one of the things that we hear is that, well, if kids take, by the way, I want to make it clear that we're not advocating that kids use drugs. That's number one. Nobody's advocating that. But one of the things that's said is that you disrupt prefrontal cortex development. The prefrontal cortex, of course, is important for planning and all those things that make
judgment,
us human.
Reason.
Absolutely. And so we say that, well, it disrupts prefrontal cortex development. Now, let's think about this. I have kids who have asthma, and they've been taking these medications for all of their life. And then there are other kids who are taking attention deficit disorder medications like amphetamines. And then you have kids who play sports like American football. All of these things certainly have potentially impact the brain, but we don't say that those things disrupt prefrontal cortex development, because prefrontal cortex development is really difficult to disrupt. Now, this isn't to say that if you are a parent, which I am, you don't want to have 14-year-olds smoking marijuana or drinking alcohol or doing tobacco or any of those sorts of things. You still have to be a parent. But the notion that we're somehow disrupting prefrontal cortex, that's been far overstated.
I can't imagine that this is resonating very well with other researchers who are doing exactly that kind of research. What kind of interaction do you have with them, and how does this either further or not further our real understanding of what happens with drugs in a kid system?
Well, you have to understand that. So my PhD is in neuroscience, and that's what the kind of research that I was doing. And so when I found out that we had overstated the case, it made me angry, because we weren't exactly being honest with the public. And also, it was taking away resources from really trying to get at the real problem. And so the interactions that I have with other researchers are, we have great discussions, and the best evidence wins. And that's the lovely thing about science. It's like, it doesn't matter if you're charismatic, it doesn't matter if you're wealthy, only evidence matters. That's the currency. And so I enjoy those conversations, because, like I said, there's virtually no evidence in humans to support this notion that we talk about, this prefrontal cortex development disruption.
I wish we had more time, but we'll hopefully talk to each other in future. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Dr. Carl Hart, for being with us. Professor Carl Hart is the chair of the Department of Psychology. He also teaches in the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University. His award-winning most recent book is High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey to Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. He was the keynote speaker at Friday's Harm Reduction Conference.